The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I wanted to start off with probably what is the most familiar and really the ultimate sort of Marxist explanation of who the police are that was propounded by four young black men from Compton. People may be familiar with the thing. I won't go into any further explanation, but as Emily was saying, the original discussion of the original title of this topic was Crime, Cops, and Capitalism. But on the program, it sort of showed up as an earlier title of Our Enemies in Blue. Now, it might seem like somewhat of a semantic difference in the title, right? Comrades might have noticed that there's a number of sessions going on in this lot dealing with the criminal injustice system. Liliana is doing a discussion of Incarceration Nation. There's a discussion going on that Helen Redman is doing, a session on the war on drugs. A whole number of things that will be taking place throughout the weekend talking about the criminal injustice system, police brutality, racism, you know, all of these things. And the title, you know, The Enemies in Blue, is actually taken from a book by Christian Williams that it's definitely worth people taking the time to check out. It's very useful in terms of an analysis of why the police are racist, why they use brutal tactics, etc. But what I actually want to do on this topic and this discussion today is talk about who are the police, what are the police, what role do the police play under capitalism? Because as Marxists, we always look at society in terms of class struggle, of class conflict, and the question inevitably arises, right? Whose question are the police, or whose side are the police on? Now, for many of us that are involved in social movements of the day, that live in poor neighborhoods, we know whose side the police are on, right? It's readily apparent. It's evident when the police arrest people on our picket lines, harass people at protests, harass young black men walking down the street, rape young women in the neighborhood of Rogers Park in this city, where people may have read about in Socialist Worker last week. A whole number of things. We know whose side the police are on. It's apparent. But every now and then the question sort of comes to the surface of, are the police working class? Are they part of the working class? They're drawn from working class communities. They're married to working class people. Their family members are part of the working class. And every now and then, they actually come out in support of the labor movement, as we saw recently in Wisconsin with the whole Cops for Labor phenomenon. So what I want to do is kind of look at a little bit of the historiography of the police, focusing especially in the United States and in Chicago in particular, because the development of the police forces, particularly around the Great Lakes industrial regions of the United States, took on an exacerbated and accelerated form compared to other parts of the country. Now, there's not a tremendous written about the origins of the police from a Marxist perspective. There's only a few things. For instance, Sidney Herring wrote a book called Policing Class Society, which is very useful for people to read if you can find it. It's long out of print and fairly pricey. So I want to sort of start out with the first part of the topic, crime, in terms of how do we assess crime, etc. So one of the important things to think about is that for the past 20 years, violent crimes in the United States have been in a significant decline. Even over the last 2 years, for instance, law enforcement agencies have reported an average drop of 5.5%. Murder rates, for instance, declined more than 50% in the period between 1991 and 1998 and continue to decline in most urban areas. These rates continue to decline even last year despite the high rates of unemployment. Now, there's been a number of theories put forward to try to explain this drop in violent crimes. One is the fact that such a large portion of the United States is already locked up and in prison. Another explanation attributes it to the decline of the so-called crack epidemic of the 1990s. And a recent theory that showed up even made the charge that video games now provide an outlet for the criminal-minded. But for many working class people, crime in our communities continues to be a problem. In fact, it's normalized. It's a part of our everyday existence. Whether you're a woman that's afraid to walk home from the train at night, fear of being attacked, from home robberies of people breaking into your home, stealing your expensive stereo system or your PlayStation, street muggings that are prominent in certain neighborhoods, and ever-present car break-ins, annoying things that mar everyday existence in working-class neighborhoods. These are a fact of life and have been a fact of life for working-class people ever since we were crammed into the urban areas and forced to fight over meager resources in our communities. The answer that we always get from the politicians and the media, however, is that we need more, stronger police forces on our streets to help prevent crime. Our only savior, we're told, is Johnny Law and the 9/11 emergency system coming to our rescue. In the newspapers, TV, and Hollywood movies, we're fed a continuous diet of the absolute necessity for police, their heroism, sometimes bending the law for the greater good, the maverick cop, and the police force has actively used this medium as a propaganda tool to help secure more wages for cops, more money for their forces, more weapons, more toys, more helicopters, more militarization, especially in the city police forces. You know, and then there's also, you know, the outrageous image recently of Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona teaming up with Hollywood cop Steven Seagal, you know, to take a tank and really raid a house with some chickens in it. You know, this is the more ludicrous outcome, right? But there's always the ever-present discussion of, you know, even in Cincinnati, which in the 1970s was one of the most militarized police forces in the country, there was the long-running joke of Sheriff Simon Lease, who had a nuclear submarine to help patrol the Ohio River. Now, despite the overall decline of violent crime in the United States, however, the rates of incarceration have been astronomical, and I'm sure that the other sessions that are going on right now are talking about this. The only comparison to the U.S. rate of 743 prisoners per 100,000 residents is the Stalinist gulag system in Russia just before World War II. They had 800 prisoners for every 100,000 residents. At the end of the year of 2007, the United States had less than 5% of the world's population, but fully 23.4% of the world's prison and jail population. Overwhelmingly, the victims of this system are working-class people, and because of the inherent racism, generally black and brown, while Native Americans constitute the highest rates of those in prison still today. Now, the explosion in the prison population is the result of a number of things. One is the prison industrial complex with private companies that continue to bank on putting people in prison. But the other thing also is the expanded definition of what actually constitutes a crime. We can chalk a lot of this up to Bill Clinton's law and order programs in the 1990s. But it goes way back into the 1870s as well. For instance, when many cities began to enforce laws against so-called vagrancy or limit the movement of tramp workers from town to town, the laws that police enforce have always targeted the poor. Today we see it when the business community encourages police to clear out homeless camps, seizing their possessions and trashing them, or when immigrant workers without proper paperwork are criminalized simply for being somewhere they're not allowed to be. So we've seen, you know, an expansion of what constitutes crime, how the police respond to it, and a whole number of things that were never considered crimes throughout human history are now being used as a reason to put people behind bars. And this is an important idea because the vast majority of crime victims in our society, both in terms of property crimes and violent crimes, are typically poor and working class people themselves. So the people that suffer most from crime in society are the very working class people that are being punished for the crime. However, police rarely respond to crime victims in working class neighborhoods, often taking a very long time to show up, if ever. Frequently, when they do, the victims themselves are often treated as criminals, with the police questioning the person's honesty, blaming the victim, which is, you know, part of what the whole slut walk thing was about. And frequently, when they do, the victims, this is so often the case that many people in working class neighborhoods simply don't even bother to call the police because of their uselessness and the treatment that they can expect to receive once the police arrive to the scene. Quite the opposite is true, however, when someone besides working class people are victimized. Recently in Chicago, we've had what the media and Rahm Emanuel, our new mayor, has referred to as flash mobs. And it's a willful distortion of what flash mobs, you know, actually are. But they charge that gangs of youth are using social media, tweets, Facebooks, etc., to organize roving gangs of youth in the city centers to engage in mass shoplifting, robberies, street muggings, etc. So there's been a couple of instances of this happening in the ritzier neighborhoods downtown, in the Loop, on the Magnificent Mile area, in Chicago's ritzy Streeterville area. And Emmanuel and the media went on a rampage against the gangs of youth. So they reassigned over 500 Chicago cops, special teams of the SWAT team, and also brought in guardian angels to staff whole street corners. So, for instance, when you go to the corner of Chicago and State where there's a McDonald's at, you can expect to see between 30 and 40 cops on any given day around rush hour, just watching for these so-called flash mobs to appear. Now, obviously, when Emmanuel and the media, you know, are become concerned about this crime, turn on the police forces and unleash the dogs, you know, they're operating under a very sort of narrow conception of crime. I think that for us, we also want to enlarge in terms of what we think are crimes from a revolutionary, from a radical, from a Marxist perspective. We say that the two cops who raped a woman in Rogers Park are criminals. That is a crime. We say that the police that harass groups of young black men on the street for just hanging out because they're a so-called gang, we call that a crime. We call when the sheriff's deputy shows up to a family's home to enforce an eviction, we call that a crime. We also call the police that are sent to enforce court injunctions to limit strikers at picket lines, we call that a crime. But this is also a normalized part of crime in working class life, right? We're used to it. We expect to be harassed by the cops. We expect the cops to show up and beat people on our picket lines. We expect the cops to show up and evict people in our neighborhoods. But this stuff gets no mention in the mainstream discussion of crime. Indeed, the common cure for crime, more cops, also has the general effect of increasing this normalized harassment and other forms of crime on the working class. And I think there was an interesting interview that showed up in the Chicago Sun-Times in the context of the flash mobs. John Cass, a reporter for, actually the Tribune, I'm sorry, was talking about, you know, flash mobs in what he called Daily Land, which is the ritzy playground for the wealthy yuppies downtown. And he interviewed a guy that was coming into the Loop to go to work from the Southside neighborhoods and asked his opinion about what he thought about the flash mobs. And he said, quote, that flash mob thing, it happens one day downtown and everybody gets nervous. Well, let me tell you, it happens on this side of town, the South Side, all the time, daily. We're exposed to it. That's how it is. I'm used to it. Now, you people, the media, are thinking it's something new. A group of people attacking a smaller group, that's nothing new. That's just the norm. They don't think it's the norm because of where it happened. But a guy gets shot in my neighborhood, that's normal. Hey, it's not even summer, and I've lost three friends. People I know have been killed. A guy named Lee. Somebody shot him in the head. Another guy, Fred, and Alex got killed. And when you think about the normal situations that people in this society are forced to live in, the meager resources that people are forced to fight over in poor neighborhoods, crime is the inevitable outcome of that. One of the more recent developments of the role of the police related to crime has not always been part of the policing role, which was initially simply the apprehension of criminals after a crime was committed, but now is also the actual prevention of crime itself, which has a number of ramifications. First of all, it means that you have to anticipate a crime. You have to be able to predict a crime. You need to be able to profile a crime, and that means profiling criminals. And due to the long legacy of racism, eugenics, Jim Crowism, etc. in this country, this has meant that the typical profile of a criminal in the United States is a poor, young black man. It's not accidental. It's not just a few bad cops that harass and intimidate people of color, but a systematic policy change in the developing police forces in an attempt to prevent crime. So now I want to sort of like step back and look at, you know, who the police are, where did they come from, what are their origins, etc. Because, you know, frequently it's sort of, you know, you grow up in the United States, there's this crime that happens, and you're told that, like, the police have always been there, and if it wasn't for the police, we would be in a state of anarchy, and everybody would be eating each other's brains. Zombie apocalypse. But the police have not always been around, nor have they always looked the same that they are today. They've gone through numerous changes, numerous shifts, various political allegiances, various roles that they played, and also, I think, importantly, the respect that they garnered from the general population has gone up and down for various reasons. Police forces also have a myriad of origins. In the New England areas, for instance, they arose from the old colonial night watchman and constable system that was imposed by the British Empire. In the South, in the border states, many police forces arose from slave-hunting vigilante groups. In the developing industrial areas around the Great Lakes region, they were cobbled together from volunteers, private security guards, and street thugs. And then there's also other instances. In New Orleans, for instance, free blacks helped to play a prominent role in the development of the police forces there. So the police forces, especially in the United States, because of the nature and origins and the development of the U.S., the expansion westward, the police developed in a combined and uneven fashion. Now, I want to focus really, though, on the areas around the Great Lakes region and Chicago, because I think that those are the areas where the development of the police was the most accelerated and the most influenced by the development of industrialized capitalism. Now, but it is worth mentioning that early colonial police in the United States under the British monarchy were under the control of the governors in the colonies. They were appointed and played a number of roles. One of the important roles that they played was actually collecting taxes. They were also the sort of verbal fire alarms, watching around for things that were going on in the neighborhood, etc. Their primary role was not preventing crime, predicting crime, profiling criminals, or even necessarily apprehending criminals. A number of the things that we associate with crime today weren't necessarily considered crime then. You could walk down the street really drunk and not end up in jail. Now, after the Revolutionary War, the newly independent towns of the United States mostly appropriated the colonial forms of policing, but now they were appointed by town mayors, sometimes elected to their positions. Indeed, they still played a number of roles that we don't associate with the police today. And there's even instances in New York of some police departments having rooms on the back of the department that served as boarding quarters for very poor people that couldn't afford hotels or more expensive rooms. And apparently some of the descriptions of them, they're just like absolutely miserable, rat-infested, flea-infested places to stay at. They were the place of last resort for poor tramp workers to stay in. These early police forces remained very small and ineffective, if not outright inept. Many reports from chiefs of police and newspapers of the period complain of officers sleeping at their posts, getting drunk every day while on duty. Police of this era generally had a very bad reputation among the general population as do-nothings. Because of this, most of the municipal governments at the time were loath to commit any city money to fund a permanent standing police force. The image of the police at this time was something more akin to Barney Fife or John P. Coltrane. In fact, one of the main impetus for utilizing some of the developing technology, the telegraph, the early phone system, etc., that were incorporated in the police departments, was to help ensure that the cops were actually on their post when they were supposed to be and that they were not out getting drunk somewhere. Similarly, the early labor movement in this country actually opposed any affiliations of police organizations to the official labor movement. And that was the official policy of even the American Federation of Labor all the way up until the convention of 1919, where the AFL took a decidedly right-wing turn in general, voting against recognition for the Soviet Union. This is only 2 years after the October Revolution there, abstaining from a proposed general strike in defense of IWW radicals, opposed the one big union, and demanding demanded more stringent immigration laws. So I think that's an important concept to sort of take in, is that the AFL actually came out in favor of police forces affiliating with the labor movement in the context of a right-wing turn around a whole number of other political issues. This is also the period of, you know, the first Red Scare, a number of other things, when the AFL was taking a more conservative approach. Only during the course of the industrial rebellions of the post-Civil War era in this country did local politicians and bosses begin to see the value of a professional standing police force. This was not a clear-cut process, but like everything else, evolved out of the process of intense class struggle at the time that proved the usefulness of the police force to the bosses. The main impetus for this was the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, which took on the character of a mass strike in several cities of the Great Lakes and Midwest region. After the police meted out a bloody repression on the streets of Chicago, which killed 37 strikers, one pro-cop city alderman noted, quote, "Some good results followed the riot of 77. As already stated, the military organization of the city received more attention than ever before and more liberal contributions." He's talking about the police force of the period. "But of more interest to us is the fact that the Chicago policeman ceased to be looked upon as a mere uniformed idler from that time on. The policeman did not stand in high popular esteem previous to this time. He was only tolerated because there still remained a doubt as to the wisdom of trying to get on without him. Nothing could be more indicative of the sentiment than the frequency with which propositions to lower the salaries of police forces came up in city council, and the language used by the aldermen in reference to the force when these propositions were debated." Imagine that today, right? "Looking over the printed reports of these meetings now, we find some rather bitter criticisms that came from the mouths of city fathers who have since patted the force on the head, so to speak, and pronounced it the finest in the world." So we begin to see the period in which the police were sort of you know, seen as the Barney Fifes, the John P. Coltranes, and really sort of paid their dues and became seen as a legitimate force that could be useful to break, especially working class rebellion in the urban centers. The development of the police was still uneven, however, and sometimes unreliable because of the political feuds that were still raging at the time. Remember, this is the era of bossism, of all sorts of stuff developing political control in especially a place like Chicago. So in 1886, for instance, Cyrus McCormick, who owned the big Reaper Works just outside of the city, refused to fire non-union molding workers that were at his Reaper plant, a demand of union workers at the time. Determined to smash the union, McCormick reopened his plant with scab labor. Then Chicago Mayor Carter Harrison bended over backwards to help out McCormick's union-busting plans. He supplied him with a detachment of 400 full-time Chicago cops who received hot meals on company property, and McCormick himself came out every morning to pour them coffee. The lockout dragged on for months and culminated in the Black Road Riot, where a special detail of 200 Chicago cops attacked workers with clubs and revolvers, wounding many and killing two. Afterwards, August Spees rushed to his print shop to print a leaflet calling for a protest in Haymarket Square the next day. Now that's the sort of popularly remembered part. But the previous year, Mayor Harrison was less generous to McCormick with the police force. During the 1885 strike, iron molders had been successful in stopping scab labor with roadblocks. When McCormick tried to rustle scabs through on trolleys, they were promptly beaten by strikers, along with a busload of Pinkertons. Panicked, McCormick called on Mayor Harrison for more adequate police protection and assistance. But Harrison refused to send them. He told McCormick to settle with the union and refused to allow police assistance. This was widely considered at the time to be in retaliation for McCormick's role in aiding Harrison's competition in the previous mayor's race on Election Day. So we can see how, you know, politics was playing a role in the development of the early police forces as well. This is a very important era for the formation of the police in terms of their role in breaking strikes, protecting the domination of capital and bosses, especially in the urban cities. Between 1886 and 1915, There were dozens of strikes by streetcar workers in a number of cities. Buffalo in 1915, Chicago in 1885, 1903, and 1915, Cleveland in 1899 and 1908, Columbus in 1890 and 1910, Detroit in 1891, Duluth in 1912, Evansville in 1907, Grand Rapids in 1891, Indianapolis in 1892 and 1913, Milwaukee in 1896, Muncie in 1908, Rochester in 1889, Saginaw in 1895, St. Louis, Terre Haute, and Toledo. All of these cities had mass strikes by streetcar workers that were very popular and had widespread community support because people rode the trains, they knew the train conductors, they needed them to get back and forth to work, etc. So when they would have strike demonstrations, picket lines, hundreds and thousands of community supporters would come out to rally for the strikers. And there were, the police played a prominent role in breaking these strikes. There were instances of the police actually doing the scab labor as part of the strike breaking. The cops began to use military organization and tactics against strikers and the sympathizers. In Milwaukee's 1896 streetcar strike, for instance, a number of streetcar strikers were arrested. But one police action also netted 12 laborers, 5 machinists, 5 schoolboys, 3 coopers, 3 teamsters, a cigar maker, a housewife, an ice peddler, an engineer, a tailor, a news dealer, a painter, a pattern maker, a conductor, a baker, a butcher. Yeah, exactly. So we can see that that this offensive by the police was not just simply against the strikers, but was utilized against the working class as a whole in these cities. In some cities like Chicago, special forces of the police were set up for permanent strike-breaking work. During the summer of 1904, for instance, there were 94 strikes underway in the city. A full 45% of Chicago's police force was detailed to full-time strike activity. During the Teamster strike the next year, which spanned much of the city, a full 75% of Chicago's police force was detailed to strike-breaking work and began issuing calls for volunteers. Given the magnitude of the strike, employers resorted to armies of professional strike-breakers to help out with the effort. Still, the strikers refused to back down, stating, and remember, this is a period of turmoil, intense class conflict, and the workers were not backing down from the violence that was being handed out to them. The strikers at the Teamster strike in Chicago wrote, quote, "The only weapon the strikers had was violence, for under present conditions, a peaceful and successful strike is an impossibility. While there are in all our cities so many non-heroic strike breakers lounging on every street corner, ready to die for unlimited beer, the striker, whether his cause is just or unjust, must be prepared to say to them, so, see here, if you try to take our jobs while we're looking for a square deal, we'll break your heads. Intimidation is the only argument that appeals to a certain class of minds." The state-sponsored violence, and really I think that we have to look at this as a conflict between, violence utilized in the class struggle, but which side is looked at as the legitimate use of violence, which side is actually sanctioned by the state and the court system, and which side is delegitimized or criminalized by the state. The state-sponsored violence continued to escalate, culminating in police violence during 2 large garment strikes in Chicago in 1910 and 1915, when wholesale clubbings of women strikers provoked outrage from the city's liberals, women's groups, and even a few aldermen. Now, it's interesting that some historians of the labor movement and police have commented that due to the relatively undeveloped capitalist state of the period and the undeveloped state of the police forces, that many departments actively sympathized with strikers. One of the things that these historians point to is the Homestead Strike, as these cops commonly lived in the same neighborhoods, were family members, and came from a working class background themselves. The few cases, however, where rank-and-file police work against strikes was lax is due more to official politics and hesitation at the top of society rather than some vague notion of sympathy with the strikers. During the Progressive Era, for instance, when unions had worked to elect sympathetic candidates to municipal office, some mayors won what were called golden rules at the time, which simply gave citations for first or second disorderly conduct infractions, and sometimes pledged to not intervene against workers during strikes. When required, however, these laws were easily forgotten about, like during the Cleveland garment strike of 1911, only 3 years after the adoption of the Golden Rule policy there, when police viciously beat strikers. Further, given the extent of the streetcar strike breaking that police participated in for over 40 years, the long list of cities that I enumerated before, I think it's quite illustrative that only on two occasions did police mount any type of opposition from below. In Columbus in 1910, when 32 cops refused to obey orders and protect scab streetcar drivers, and in Indianapolis 3 years later, when 29 cops refused a similar order. These were merely exceptions that proved the rule of the role of the police in those cities in breaking the strikes. Methods to inhibit the police from identifying with working class struggles and strikers are very important to think about. Better pay and respect for police officers generally sets them aside from lower class, working class people who are more prone to striking. And municipal governments, mayors, exploited the ethnic and racial tensions that always existed in their cities. Typically, most police in this era of large cities were made up of Irish or German people, whereas most of the police that they were policing, the people that they were policing were members of immigrant groups, Polish, Italian, Bohemian, Jewish, many people that couldn't speak English at all. Now, I think that it's worth noting that the police in this period also paid a special attention to radicals, anarchists, and socialists. From petty harassment like preventing militants from simply speaking on street corners to the vicious wave of beatings and arrests in the wake of the Haymarket incident. By 1902, Chicago's chief of police, Francis O'Neill, summarized the effects. Quote, "There are still in Chicago a large number of anarchists, but they are no longer defiant. They have been made to feel the effectiveness of the law when the community is aroused and by all outward appearances fear the law. If they do not respect it. They no longer indulge in incendiary talk calculated to incite acts of violence. Close surveillance is kept on the leaders by the police in Chicago, and they cannot make a move of any importance that is not known to the authorities in a short time." Now, while private strike breakers like the Pinkertons have gotten a lot of exposure in labor history and movies, etc., they had been mostly used successfully in rural areas against miners, farm workers, that type of thing. Rarely were they successful in actually suppressing strikes in the industrial centers. It became much more useful for the municipal administrations to maintain a permanent standing police force. First of all, in the case of striking breaks. Breaking strikes, but then also in regulating the day-to-day interactions and relations of the working class, regulating things like drinking establishments, gambling, vagrancy laws, a whole number of things meant to help keep the working class in order and showing up for the jobs the next day. Now, it was also a result of some of the worst offenses that the Pinkertons and the private security guards had committed over a number of years that even some politicians were reacting that they had widely become illegitimate in the eyes of the population. The Congress of Industrial Relations wrote that one of the greatest functions of the state, that of policing, was virtually turned over to the employers or arrogantly assumed by them, and criminals employed by detective agencies were clothed by the process of deputization with arbitrary power and relieved of criminal liability for their acts. So it became clear to the ruling class, the politicians, and to the bosses that they needed a force that was under their control and that they could use to legitimize themselves. Now, I have a number of things I'm not going to go into the role of strike breaking today. Most of the stuff that I talked about was in the late 19th century, early 20th century, but suffice it to say that we have a number of instances in recent memory, from the attack on longshoremen in Charleston, South Carolina in 1999, the attack on Latino janitors in Los Angeles in 1990, the vicious attack on Detroit newspaper strikers in 1995. Now, I think it's important to sort of mention, what Marx and Engels had to say about the role of the police. Engels actually described, the state, the second part of the Marxist conception of the state, as being the establishment of a public power which no longer directly coincided with the population organizing itself as an armed force. This special public power is necessary because a self-acting armed organization of the population has become impossible since the cleavage into classes. This public power exists in every state. It consists not merely of armed people, but also of material adjuncts, prisons, and institutions of coercion of all kinds. It may be very insignificant, almost infinitesimal, in societies where class antagonisms are still undeveloped and in out-of-the-way places, as was the case at certain time in certain regions in the United States of America. It grows stronger, however, in proportion as class antagonisms within the state become more acute and as adjacent states become more and larger populated, larger and more populated. So here we see, you know, early on in American history, the police playing a somewhat marginal role, an inept role, and as the intensification of the class struggle and class warfare heated up during the latter part of the 19th century, the police became a more established, professionalized organization with a more explicit role in coercing the working class to go back to work instead of striking and fighting for their rights. There's a number of other things that I wanted to lay out in terms of some of the differences with the police in the United States. The vast majority of the police in the United States are funded by local governments rather than federal governments. This has meant that they've been more susceptible to some of the political intrigues of municipalities and cities. And I also want to sort of, I'm out of time, we can talk about this in the conversation, but there actually has been a number of instances in the context, and I think it's important to state this, in the context of tremendous social upheaval and tremendous and very sharp class conflict, that police forces have actually gone into motion around a number of things, most famous of which is the Boston police strike of 1919, when police went out on strike and brought voice to a number of the grievances that existed within the rank and file of the police department. The Socialist Party, Louis Fraina, especially at the time, came out and played a very strong supportive role of the Boston police in the period, and there has been a number of other police strikes that have happened since then, just out in Cicero in the early 1970s, in the wake of the 60s radicalization and the early labor movement in this country, etc. And then again, we've also witnessed the entrance of the police for labor into the Wisconsin Solidarity protests. Now, in conclusion, though, I want to say that rather than seeing crime as some innate part of humanity, or of certain sections of humanity, as the racist arguments go, that Marxists instead see the roots of crime in the system of class domination that creates and recreates notions of criminality. Vagrancy was never a problem in human history until people were forced off the land. Street muggings were never a problem until working class people were crammed into unhealthy urban slums and forced to fight over scraps of an existence. Selling drugs was never a crime until the advent of a pharmaceutical industry. Most of all, the role of police, and I think this is essential for us to understand, the role of police under capitalism should be understood is that they play the primary apparatus for coercion of the working class. The role of the police is to protect the domination of capital, to keep the working class in check, to make sure that they're living lives that provides an ample labor supply, that they're going to work every day, that they're not destroying the boss's machines, that they're not taking over the machines, that they're not causing chaos in the city, and that they're not disrupting a good environment for business. The police are not part of the working class. They're not part of the labor movement. They're the primary way that the state and the bosses keep the working class in check.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.